This podcast will focus on the force projection and sustainment of U.S. forces in a near-peer competition. It includes insights and commentary from the moderator, SES retired Guy Boer, who will pose questions to two of the most well-known and qualified national security senior logisticians, General retired Gus Perna, former COO of Operation Warp Speed and Commanding General of Army Materiel Command, and General retired Steve Lyons, former U.S. Transcom Commander and Joint Chief of Staff J-4.
So, gentlemen, first, it's a privilege to engage with two premier heavyweight logisticians like yourselves. This is a meaningful engagement since I know we all cut our teeth in an army where our focus was to defeat U.S. near-peer competitors. Once again, our current focus for readiness and doctrine revolves around competition with near-peer competitors, which involve much larger formations than the brigade combat team-centric operations we've executed over the last two decades. The military element of power will require a very different approach than we have had in the previous two decades. Also, today's supply chains seem to be in distress in both DoD and domestic arenas. These supply chains often rely on offshore manufacturing and raw materials, sometimes within the control of our near-peer competitors. So, General Lyons, taking into consideration the current situations in Europe and the Western Pacific, as well as the last two decades of operating in Iraq and Afghanistan, what logistics lessons or insights should we take away when preparing to fight a near-peer competitor?
Well, Guy, it's a pleasure to join you today with my good friend, General Perna. You know, on the topic of near-peer multi-domain warfare implications for logistics, what I often do is I first remind people of what doesn't change, and that's the purpose of military logistics and the framework for how to implement strategic logistics. So let me just say, you know, the purpose of logistics is enduring, and that's the ability to project and sustain military forces. That enables global reach, freedom of action, operational momentum, as you know. And we do this by anticipating logistics demands like consumption, failure, damage, destruction, and reconstitution requirements stemming from battle. Sometimes we get lost in the many logistics and supply chain activities, but it all comes back to one enduring purpose. And by its nature, logistics is a physics problem, the movement of people, equipment and supplies, and time and space. And this requires an organizational design, or as I like to call it, a logistics warfighting framework that has three really important aspects. And I'll just cover them quickly, and I'll address your question. You know, first and foremost, a resilient global posture, one that's enabled by like-minded partners providing critical access, basing, and overflight. A resilient global posture provides the United States and our partners a physical, temporal, and psychological advantage over potential adversaries, and it's a key deterrent. Second, of course, we must have logistics capacity that's necessary to replace lost combat potential. And third, you have to have the ability to control and prioritize the allocation of scarce resources to the highest operational priorities. I think it's important to appreciate that framework to address your underlying question of how do things change in a potential global war with a near peer. You know, basically what we're saying is that we must achieve the same purpose using the same framework to enable combat operations under all domain persistent attack. And as you can imagine, the scale, scope, intensity, and cost associated with a near-peer conflict increases dramatically relative to operations, let's say, over the last 20 years. So let me give you an example. Our most taxing war plans are akin to moving a large city. Imagine having to move every person, every car, every bus, every truck from the Cincinnati metro area all the way overseas. That represents the equivalent of our largest war plans. But then when you look at emerging multi-domain concepts with increased distances, enhanced speed, decentralized operations, paired against the destructive capabilities of a near-peer adversary, as you can imagine, all the drivers of logistics increase dramatically. Effectiveness and resiliency are keys to success, often at the expense of efficiency. All potential single points of failure must be eliminated. It is a costly proposition. We have not witnessed that level of combat operations since World War II. So the challenge is, yes, they would be significant, but not insurmountable.
So, General Lyons, what are the most significant strategic logistic challenges that DOD and Congress must address to ensure the United States retains its ability as a superpower to deploy military forces globally in a near-peer scenario?
Well, it's a great question. And we must be able to continue to deter and ultimately win in an all-out war with a near-peer. You know, Secretary Mattis would often say the United States would only be a regional power without TRANSCOM. In truth, he was really referring to the power of our broader joint logistics enterprise. You know, it's an acknowledgement that our ability to project military power globally is an asymmetric advantage and a critically important deterrent. But I'll mention a few things that are critical as we continue to evolve in anticipation of future adversaries and future operating environments. First, we need to invest in CLIF recapitalization to be able to move the Army's decisive force. Now, think about this. 33 of 50 of our large Navy roll-on, roll-off ships designed to carry combat formations will reach end of useful life over the next 10 years. We also need to continue to invest in aerial refueling and airlift that enable the critical time-sensitive ability to deploy forces immediately, like the recent deployments to Europe that you mentioned, and as you well know, the non-combatant evacuation operation in Afghanistan. Now, I'll just note, there are advocates that want to cut the C-5 Galaxy airlifter without replacement. Well, that represents a 25% reduction in the Air Force's oversized and outsized airlift capability. That's a step in the wrong direction. We need to take a hard look at the vulnerabilities associated with our liquid energy supply chain. This is a recurring insight in our joint war games. We need to continue efforts to improve cyber resiliency across the joint deployment and distribution enterprise. In general, I'd say we need to better integrate the sustainment warfighting function with other warfighting functions like intelligence, fires, maneuver protection. Every platform must become a sensor and, frankly, a potential shooter. And finally, we need to identify and invest in new warfighting methods that still possess the ability to compel our adversaries consistent with our national security goals, but that don't continue to drive logistics costs to an unaffordable level. I think if we truly understood, right, the increasing cost associated with the joint logistics demands, we would probably alter our investment decisions today and into the future. So I'll stop there, but those are a few areas I believe worthy of attention to ensure the United States retains its sole superpower status.
General Lyons, thanks for those insightful answers. General Perna, taking into consideration the current U.S. domestic and DoD supply chain challenges, there are many opinions and recommendations to become more insular with regard to how and where our supply chains operate. What consideration should the Defense Department give to a supply chain risk, and particularly the early stages of procurement programs like the Common Tactical Truck or the Future Vertical Lift Weapon Systems?
Hey, Guy, thanks for the opportunity to be here and really to be a part of listening to General Lyons talk, which I learn something every time. So it's just an honor to be with you today. Look, very complex problem, I believe, though, has simple solutions if we're willing to solve the problem and not chase symptoms. And it starts off with the early definition of what is the purpose of each supply chain and how is it being utilized to that purpose. For example, if industry is going to choose a just-in-time delivery of repair parts because of its financial benefits, because of its ability to manage workload, et cetera, that is a course of action. Or if industry is going to manage it by flow, right, which causes different things to occur, right? We're going to have to be consistent. We're going to deliver on a repetitive basis. We are going to stock in order to deliver, you know, based on the demand. Both have, you know, pros and cons, but that's the fundamental decision that has to be made up front. After that decision is made, though, there is several things that have to occur. And over the years, what we've done collectively, industry and DOD, is we figured out how to work around what should be the right way of doing this. For example, we need a timely and consistent budget. We need the budget to come out of time from the Hill. We needed to be consistent over time. We needed to be focused based on the needs of the country and why we want the Department of Defense and the Army. And without that, you cannot plan appropriately and accordingly to manage the supply chain. Next, we need to maintain an operational tempo minus war that allows us to have consistent and repetitive training so that we can identify and implement the right algorithms to provide the best predictability to what is needed, you know, to support the readiness of our fleets and our weapons and communications. Algorithms and op tempo can be disjointed, and we can make poor decisions if it's not the right ones that are being utilized. For example, when we were all younger, my interpretation, our demand policy, you know, how much demand was put on the system would regulate how much we thought we were going to need, you know, in our ASLs, et cetera. The truth, though, is that that was also managed by the algorithm inside of that policy. And the algorithm forced, I would say, poor planning and poor execution because we would only have it set for one real training event a year, i.e. the National Training Center. So we had a demand policy, which regulated when we could order things. Then we added an algorithm that only illuminated execution primarily once a year. And the result of that was we had a poor demand signal. And that signal did not allow us to understand the requirement nor industry to prepare to support that requirement. So we got to get that matched up. We need to make sure policy is consistent, right? We got to define purpose of the supply chain in the policy level, and we got to avoid emergency policy decisions. For example, you know, money is tight at the Army level. So we come up with some policy that says, you know, only safety things we're going to do, or we're not going to do 10-20, we're going to do whatever, right? We can't have a policy that goes up and down based on strategic dollars. In the same light, we can't have policies being made at the tactical level by division commanders because, you know, they're managing their tactical budgets and they're holding monies, right? And they're not buying repair parts on a repetitive, consistent basis as they're trying to manage their budget. First of all, we need planning and we need money to be working together. We need to create a consistent demand in support of our requirement. Then we illuminate the right demand and industry can prepare for that demand if they decide how they want to support us. Additionally, what we really need is standards and discipline to be executed on both sides. The military needs to execute with high standards and high discipline from the tactical all the way up to the strategic level, you know, as early as how do we do motor stables? How often do we order repair parts? When do we turn in recoverables? How often do we draw repair parts from the supply support activities? Industry needs to be dependable in their deliveries and executions accordingly. Both, if not executed at a high standard, will cause both the military and the industry to start working workarounds or cheat to meet requirements. For example, if the tactical unit thinks that they're not going to get something, they start ordering 4 or 5 or 10 widgets. And then industry has to kind of jump at that. Whereas if we were consistent and predictable, we'd only order one because we'd have confidence that that one would be there. What we want to do is take the disruption or the sporadic ordering out of our routine. And if we do that, we'll have a better chance of maintaining the flow of repair parts. I'll leave everybody with this simple analogy because I think it's so important. Collectively, we have to understand, you know, the purpose of the United States Army. The purpose of the United States Army, as General Lyons articulated, is to go to war and win. Right. And so if you can visualize an armor battalion at the line of departure, 44 tanks, and they've been given a mission and they're 12 hours out and they're doing their preparatory work and they're getting ready to go, what you don't want is in that 12 hours before they cross the line of departure, 10 to 14 of those tanks to go down for whatever reason, right? One quarter of the fleet. And if they do go down, what you really want is for them to be able to just reach behind them and get the part right there, the availability of the part. Our goal is 44 tanks cross the line of departure. If we do that, nobody can defeat us. Without that, though, with a quarter of the end strength being down, right, then we have a problem. Then we have to talk about other things like end strength, etc. So our goal is to have the repair parts there where we need it. We need predictable and consistent funding. We need predictable up-tempo in training. We need standards and discipline in execution. And we need both industry and the military to operate in a transparent and open manner.
Thanks, General Perna. This leads me to my second question. It's really one that has emanated from industry. The aftermarket industry is currently struggling with their first, second, and third tier level suppliers who often go out of business or shut a line down because of low demand that they've witnessed because of a reduced op tempo over the last few years or so. And this is ultimately going to cause lead times in many instances to double as they either have to get raw material or stand a line back up. Also, the recently high inflation rates are driving the costs up in IDIQ contracts negotiated before this inflation existed. And these first, second, and third tier suppliers are raising their rates to their primes who have these IDIQ contracts. What can industry and government do to mitigate these two things that are causing trouble in the aftermarket industry?
Yeah, Guy, look, you just railed off four excellent questions. And I know even at the best of our ability during this session, we'll only hit the wave tops on all four. And the people listening are smart enough to understand that. And I believe these problems can be solved, but I think we collectively have to make some hard decisions to this end. And again, it's about the purpose of our military. If we have great clarity of that, and we all understand that, and we're all trying to achieve that purpose, understanding that there's individual and organizational purposes that have to be kept in mind, we can come to these conclusions. But I think there's some drastic things that have to happen. You know, I think we have to make some decisions about our acquisition strategies. Are we here to keep everybody employed, small business, all the way up through large industry capabilities? Or are we here to make sure that the repair parts exist when we need them? Are we willing to build manufacturing capabilities here in the United States, knowing that we have environmental challenges, that we have labor challenges, that we have potentially access to material challenges? You know, they're clearly a cost to manufacture here in the United States versus manufacturing overseas for the myriad of things I just listed will come into play. And then you have to define, you know, which is more important. Is it industry survival in profit or is it the military survival in readiness? I'm breaking this down in simplistic form. There's a lot more people. Policy has to be, you know, involved in order to solve this. But I believe what we need to do is make some draconian decisions to the end state. And if we do that, I think we can come to some really good conclusions that would enable and improve our ability to support the requirement accordingly. Our supply chains are incredibly diversified. You know, everything is involved from the materials we need, the manufacturing capability that we want, the distribution nodes of them, and taking all of this collectively, when you look at it, is how you're going to solve the problem that you identified. It's not going to be, again, chasing the symptoms. It's going to be about solving the problems to that end. I would say that everything should start in a thought process. You know, how do we collaborate at the research and development level with those that have to supply those minerals and materials to create, you know, the items that we need? Things that we can do where these things are more abundant are clearly advantageous to us. when we create things that have limited supply availability, either by location or in itself, you know, make the overall challenging. So how do we collaborate early on with R&D and then the requirements, you know, and the acquisition strategies is really an important node as we go forward. Again, a very difficult challenge. One, I believe we could overcome if we define purpose and we work together, you know, with a unity of effort, and we come to some draconian conclusions about how to get there, I think is the best way to achieve success.
General Perna, thanks again. Some very insightful comments and answers. I would like to give both of you another bite at the apple when you think about U.S. logistics, when we hit an era of near-peer competition and where we really want to head and what we have to do immediately. General Lyons.
Hey, Guy. Yeah, thanks. You know, like General Perna, you know, I always go back to the underlying purpose, and he and I have been hanging around a long time. So we're like-minded in some of these areas. For the Department of Defense, that purpose is to provide combat-credible forces needed to deter, and if deterrence fails, obviously, just like he said, we got to win decisively, regardless of the environment, today and into the future. We've got to evolve. And there are, in fact, critical business aspects associated with logistics that are essential and necessary. And to General Perna's point, you know, alignment, getting alignment on purpose to get the outputs right is so critical to get all those activities aligned. And it's no small challenge. You do get a sense for the natural friction, I think, between balancing effectiveness and efficiency in our risk calculus. I would like to close just by saying one thing, though. And that is how proud I am of our Joint Logistics Warfighters. They are absolutely amazing in what they accomplish every day. You can only imagine the war stories General Perna and I could tell. Thanks, Guy, again for the time today and the opportunity. I appreciate all that you and General Perna are doing. Back to you.
General Perna, closing comments.
Yeah, over. Guy, thanks. And Steve nailed it. Just to feed off your last comment. I've said it before, General Lyons has said it before, many of us have said it before. We can't go into the next near-peer competition without industry and everything that they bring to the fight. I've testified to that. I've said it in senior leader meetings. I coach it to younger officers. You are a very important part of our future success on the battlefield. And I believe that with all my heart. I do believe that the partnership is such that we have our defined purposes and we try to bring them together through unity of effort, but sometimes they conflict. And that's okay. That's the way things work. We just have to see ourselves and understand that and hold each other accountable. Hold us accountable for the budget. Hold us accountable for the op-tempo demand. Hold us accountable for standards and discipline and execution. We need to do the same with you. You know, you say you're going to do something, then you need to do it. You know, we shouldn't have to manage the work for you. You know, for example, at one time I had general officers calling your subs collectively to figure out how things were working. And I had to put an end to that. Stop calling subs, only call primes, hold them accountable to execution. I want to bring to everybody's attention or recommend to everybody, there's a book called Freedom's Forge. Everybody in our business, logistics and sustainment business, and everybody in the Army and industry that supports that should read this book. Just my personal opinion. The book talks about and articulates, you know, what we had to do to get ourselves ready for World War II. And it goes through a myriad of, you know, personalities and how we led our way through that and the difficulties and the challenges and getting things ready. And then how long it actually took to do, because there's a false narrative or false expectation or a false memory that we're just going to instantaneously have all the infrastructure, materials, and people to develop what we will truly need, you know, for a near peer competition that lasts more than, you know, 72 hours. And so I coach you to read this because, you know, in general, the facts are there was a lot of planning and strategy that started as early as 1939, but it was not enacted until 41. And it was not until 43 that we had enough volume of planes, ground maneuver equipment, ships, ammunition, weapons, communications, in order to defeat the enemy, right? So think about that four-year span, 2 years of planning, enacted in 41, and then 2 years of execution to create the volume that was needed. Now, we should all collectively be proud of that, the United States of America and the teamwork to that end. But what I remind people all the time, when it comes to logistics and sustainment, it is a true strategic advantage, as General Lyons pointed out. We ought to understand that and always take advantage of it. But the enemy knows this too, right? And they're going to figure out ways to start interacting or stopping us before we even get started. And you need to think about what that means, whether that is through cyber, whether that is, you know, inside of our own perimeter, you know, inside CONUS, whether it is in our OCONUS operations, et cetera. The easiest way to, you know, to win the war is to prevent us from even getting over to the war, never mind sustaining the war. This is really important. The strategic support area, in my mind, is both the capability we have to manufacture, store, and distribute equipment and commodities from CONUS to wherever we need it. Industry is a big part of the strategic support area. We have to work together to that end. We have to understand the laws of physics to that end. And if we do that collectively, I think we could remain powerful throughout our lifetime and beyond.
So General Lyons, General Perna, thanks for your time today. I will tell you, I think there are gold nuggets with what we've heard today for both industry and government. And also, thank you for your service.